Why do I conduct my show on this manner? Mondo!
Sweet mother of God, what is the holdup?
Eleanor!
Once again, something wonderful in my life has been turned into a giant crap fest.
Mondo!
Got a little bit more cock for you here.
Eleanor!
Bowtie boy got the big snaggeroonie.
Mondo!
Oh, six of my nipples are tingling.
Eleanor!
See why America loves him so much?
Mondo!
I'd like to smash you in the face with my shillelagh.
Eleanor!
I have no idea what's going on.
Mondo!
He was lying.
He said he never tells a lie.
He was lying when he said that.
Eleanor!
I want a cup.
Well, could you spell that?
C-U-P. I want to see you. Oh, my God.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Stomach batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
For God's sake, strap yourself down.
That's right. It's the show your bosses don't want you to listen to. The show that's going to tell you the truth about what's going on in the workplace. So wake the hell up. It's the Cup of Joe radio show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Our engineer, Sock Puppet Sam, is here!
Hey, Joe, how are you?
And we've got a lot of stuff to talk about, but first, Sam, give us the URL for the site.
That's cupojoe.blogspot.com.
And the email address.
joevec@bellsouth.net.
All right, I want to welcome all of my fans listening in at the White Rose Society. That's whiterosesociety.org. My good friend Ben Birch hosting my archives there. And, of course, all my fans at rantsradio.com listening in on Thursdays and Sundays. Okay, it is Sunday, just about 10 p.m. here on September 26th. And my wife and I just got back from Anime Week in Atlanta, the convention that we attended over the weekend. And it was a pretty good show. And for those of you who are not aware of this, I'm a fan of anime, Japanese cartoons. And about 10 years ago, well, pretty much 10 years ago, I helped to start a convention for Japanese cartoons here in Atlanta. It's called Anime Week in Atlanta. I was one of the three main directors. And my primary responsibility, apart from helping get the hotel and secure all of that stuff, was to put together the convention guides, because I had been doing newsletters and stuff like that for many years. And it was a fun show. And it's interesting because a lot of my anime friends have very similar tastes in politics than I do, and some have very different tastes in politics. And it has strained some relationships. In fact, my nemesis, Bichon, is one of that group. He did not come to AWA for the first time this year, and part of it is because not so much his political points of view, but because, as you've noticed if you read the comments, he has a habit of making some pretty outrageous statements and not backing down from them, and that has cost him more than a few friendships. Hang on a second, let me get a drink of water here. Oh, excuse me. Professional radio, ladies and gentlemen. I apologize profusely. But we had an okay time this weekend, and we'll go back again next year, and maybe I'll get a little bit more involved this year. I kind of went into retirement from it over the last few years, because it's a lot of work, and I decided that I wanted to devote more of my time to the blog, and more specifically now to the radio, and all that. Digby. Let's get on to the politics. And Digsby had a post a little while ago. Hang on. Let me go over to Digsby's blog, because it was really pretty good. And he was talking about how he why he does what he does. And let's see. Where is that? There you go. And there were a couple articles. There was an article in the LA Times, and there was an article in the New York Times Magazine about blogging. And he talked about, you know, why he does what he does. And he wrote, "It's all about linkage. The blogosphere is a beehive in which the queen bee bloggers, and he's talking about really Atrios and ghosts and other that serve and are served by the rest of the colony. As Atrios points out in the comments, as long as some of the top bloggers continue to link to other blogs, the blogosphere as we know it will continue to thrive. People need hubs and starting points to make their way through all the buzzing, and that's what the popular blogs provide. Commercialization in terms of blog ads doesn't have much to do with it so far because the ads don't seem to conflict with the content. And there was the reason why that was all brought up is because there was a discussion that maybe the blogosphere is getting is reaching the end days as far as importance is concerned. And I'm not really sure how true that is. And I wrote in the comments and I said, you know, sometimes I wonder whether it's worth all the effort I put into this. I mean, as far as blogging is concerned, I don't have the time to make several posts a day like Atrios and Coast do. And, of course, Coast has several people working, which always makes it easier, of course. And because I work in the type of workplace that I do, which is a fairly physical job, sometimes when I get home, I am far too tired to do much more than just check my email and read a few sites before I've got to settle in for the evening. And when I get up during the day, I have things that I need to do before I go to work, so I don't always have the time to put into the blog. So as much as I'd like to get the kind of numbers that Atrios and Coast gets, the truth of the matter is I'm surprised and I'm happy to get the 60 to 100 somewhat hits a day that I get. And I do get a lot more hits when I post a comment onto Atrios' site. And Atrios at least reads Digby. He reads Hullabaloo. And well, he should, because it is a very good site. It's one of the best. Just go in there, look in under my regular reads, and click on that link, and you'll see it. But Digby is a pretty good site, and he is read by Atrios, and Atrios will sometimes just post to him and say, yeah, what he said, basically. And again, there's good reason for that, because Digby does a very good job of it. And I'm going to try to get Digby on the show, by the way, but that's another story. And his hits, of course, go through the roof when that happens, but they don't seem to stick. I mean, they'll go there for a little while, then they'll go away. And I'll get a whole bunch of hits when I post a comment on Atrio's site, or I write a diary. Well, actually, I won't get quite so many when I write one of the diaries, as they call it, on Coast, Daily Coast. But, you know, I certainly see when my hits go up and when they don't. And obviously, the more attention you pay to your blog, the more hits you're going to get, the more work you're willing to do as far as publicity is concerned. And, you know, that takes time, and time is something that's in short supply. I wish I didn't have to sleep, because if I didn't have to sleep, I could do so much work at night and then do, you know, my regular working for a job thing for during the day. But, you know, I really can't do it that way. I've got to sleep sometime. So, you know, you just do the best you can. You know, you do the best you can. And realistically, I can't be like Atrios, and I can't be like Daily Coast and do what they do. So the best that I can do is try to provide some other form of thing that people can listen to. And I was told by somebody at the convention who I had talked to about the blog that it is pretty good. The number of hits that I'm getting a day is really not that bad. It's really pretty good to be getting 60 to 100 hits a day or so. And I really don't think it's that many when you consider the hundreds of thousands that go on to Atrios and to Coast and to Bart Cop and all that. I wish I had that kind of audience. But, you know, I guess my personality really isn't tuned in or isn't really geared to what a lot of people want to hear. A lot of people want to hear the yelling and the screaming and the bombasticness, and Atrios does that sometimes. But really with Atrios, it's more like he'll comment on a story or he'll link to a story and make a very brief comment. Coast is very, very different. Coast will really go ahead and give polls for statewide elections and talk about specific candidates, and he really digs in deep and gets in there in a way that I really can't do. Digby, what he does is write very nice long articles, long diatribes, and sometimes he'll quote long links from other articles and make comments about that. My blog tends to be a little bit more personal because that's the way I like to frame the issues on a very personal level, because I know that some people understand Let me get that thing out of there. Maybe that buzzing will go away now. That some people simply understand that the policies of the government do have an effect on the workplace and how everybody works. And so what I try to do is show how that how these effects take place, how these things happen. And the things that bother me most is how little working people work together, you know. And they really should work together more. They really should, but they don't. They don't. And one of the other bloggers, and we're going to be talking to him a little later on, one of the other bloggers who does a wonderful job is someone who actually is a more or less a professional. He's a professor of history, and he has written journals about the Middle East, and that's Professor Juan Cole of the University of Michigan, and his site, juancole.com. And again, you can just go on the blog and you can link it there. It's right there on the regular reads because I read him regularly. If you want to find out what's going on in Iraq, this is the site to read because he will tell you more about what's going on in Iraq than you're going to read in any American newspaper or see on any American television show. That is an absolute fact. And he will give you a proper perspective on it. He'll tell you, you know, why a certain person is doing a certain thing as far as, you know, Muqtada Sadr or Ayatollah Sistani, who might very well become the eventual leader of Iraq, the way things are going there. But it's a tremendous site, and he's very knowledgeable about the area. He lived there for 10 years, and I will have an interview with him a little later on in the show in about 10 minutes or so, 10, 15 minutes. He is really, really good, and he provides something that these other bloggers don't. It's important to me to be the best that I can be. I mean, I can go out there and try to be a bombastic talk show host like some of the like all the right wingers are and like some of the left wingers are, or I can try to be that old school liberal intellectual thing, and that's really not my bag either. I am what I am, you know, and that's about all I can say about it. Is that I am trying to be the best me that I can possibly be. I really am. And that's really how it's going to work. As I mentioned on the blog in my most recent post, not counting the open thread for this show, I just feel like I have to try to be the best me that I can become and not try to be the second best something else. You know, I mean, because that's really all I have. And if I start changing for other people, you know, and I don't mind people giving me suggestions, and that's fine. But if I start just changing willy-nilly because someone says I should change, then, you know, I'm pretty much useless to anybody. So why do I do what I do? Why do I waste my time with this? Why do I fill the few hours that I have that I'm not working or doing important stuff with this? Why does this take up so much of my time? I do it for the same reason that Atrios and Coase and Digby and all of them, because I feel compelled to do it, because I want to make my voice heard in the world, because I want somebody somewhere to know, as my good friend AB, who gave me this computer equipment, told me about how his mother felt, that there's someone else out there who thinks the same way. You know, this is important stuff going down. The stuff that we're doing in Iraq, the current election, all the direction that the country and the world is taking, this is important stuff. And for better or for worse, I'm going to put my voice to it, at least as far as how it affects me and how it affects, I believe, regular working people. You know, people who aren't as ambitious, perhaps, as I am, because, you know, of the people who I work with, at least I have an idea of something that I want to do in the future. And a lot of them really do not. Above and beyond, we're going to keep working for the company and maybe retire. And it's an unfortunate fact that a lot of them are going to wind up getting screwed over, going from job to job, or sticking with the same job and maybe being lucky and getting to be retired, you know, getting a pension when they retire, and assuming they get to keep that. If they get it, because if the things keep going the way they are in this country, they're going to be robbed of their pensions sooner or later. Because, you know, those people aren't going to be satisfied with just having the money that they have, and they're going to find more ways to squeeze as much money out of they possibly can out of us, and as much work as they possibly can out of us. And so even though I don't get along with a lot of them, I basically want to help protect them because I want to help protect myself. I mean, it is eventually about me. It is eventually about me. And it's about you too. I mean, I'm not looking to just protect myself at everybody else's expense. I want everybody to be protected at their workplace. And, you know, they just passed that overtime law, which means they're going to screw us over more. And I'm sure they're not going to do it all at once because that would be too fucking obvious. But there's going to be a lot of people who are going to lose all their overtime pay. 60 years of overtime law tossed aside. And I don't want to say just like that because it didn't happen just like that. It took, you know, the last 30 years or so of the right wing working fervently to stop it, to put an end to it. And, you know, minimum wage law is going to be next, I'm sure. And, of course, they just voted to raise taxes on the very poor, getting rid of some exemptions that the poor had. So, you know, they're the ones that are going to be paying most of the burden while, you know, the guys up on top pay less and less. And I remember on FDR's first inauguration speech how we talked about how taxes have risen and our ability to pay them has gone down. And that's what's happening again. And I don't know if this is going to be a forever thing, that if it's always going to be like this. But when it, you know, the thing about it is we have to be constantly vigilant. And fucking Grover Norquist from the Heritage Foundation guy. Is that Norquist? Or that doesn't really fucking matter. They're all scum. But Norquist said that the reason why, and this was in an interview in a foreign newspaper, and someone asked him about demographics changing, and he said, well, the reasons why the demographics are changing to the Republicans' favor is because the people who fought World War II, the people who enacted the New Deal, who are active in that and remain politically active for many years, are starting to finally die out in large numbers. And, you know, and basically his attitude was good riddance, which is wonderful. You know, this is, you know, these were the people that made America the military and moral powerhouse that it was from the end of World War II on and through the 60s and into the 70s. And basically, until scumbags like Richard Nixon came along and just fuck things up for everybody. And all the really major league scumbags come from the right. Joe McCarthy, Richard Nixon. You know, they're all scum. Democrats have had their share of it, too. I mean, Lyndon Johnson, you know, was a mean son of a bitch in his own right. And I guess he kind of had to be working in Texas politics. But, you know, the difference between Lyndon Johnson in Vietnam and George Bush in Iraq is that, as you know by the tape recordings that we have now of Johnson that get released from time to time, he felt horrible about what was going on. It was really affecting him. And he talked about it with his national security people. And he said, this is just a horrible mess, but, you know, I don't know how to get it out. In public, his face was all for support of the war, which he felt he had to be. He had a duty to. He had a duty, he felt, to the soldiers to keep the face up and saying things are going well. And to the families and to the American public in general. But in private, he was like, my God, what have we gotten ourselves into? You don't sense any of that from George Bush. I mean, these are poor working people that are the ones that are suffering and paying the price for the decisions of this administration. And they could care less. Just like they could care less for the working poor when they pass these overtime laws. And when they pass these laws raising or, you know, pass these tax raises, which is what they are. And here I have guys at work. There's a guy at work who will sit there and say, well, I don't want Kerry because he's going to raise my taxes. And say, what are you, a fucking idiot? You know, sometimes you just want to, you want to go, you know, hello, McFly. You know, wake the fuck up. You know, ask yourselves this question. If you still have a pay stub from the year 2000, take a look at it and compare it to a pay stub today, just recently. And look at it. And look at the amount of taxes that you're paying. And look at how much you were paying as a percentage of your income in 2000. And look at how much you're paying as a percentage of your income now. If it has stayed the same or even gone up a little, as I know it has with mine, and you continue to vote Republican, if you have, I'm talking to mainly people who vote Republicans, but still, if you're really paying that much less taxes under George Bush, then you should continue to vote for George Bush. Okay? But if you're a working person and you're finding you're paying as much taxes, if not more, and you're considering for voting for Bush based on the idea that Kerry's going to raise your taxes or Bush is going to lower your taxes, you're a fucking idiot. I mean, I can't put it any more simply than that. You know, you have to, you don't, never listen to what a politician says. You watch what they do. That's the important thing. I mean, Bush is a master of this. He'll go out and he'll say one thing and do exactly the opposite. He'll turn right around and do it. He'll do it boldly. He'll do it right out in the fucking open. And he just won't care. He doesn't have to care because he knows that he will never face the consequences of his actions. Somebody else will always take the fall for George W. Bush because someone else always has. And unless we rise up to stop him and his people, who also will never face the feel that they will never face the consequences of their actions, unless we rise up to put an end to it, they never will. And we also have to understand that we do not have the press on our side. The professional media is not going to do the job it's supposed to be doing. And that's why I do what I do. There is no other reason for me to be doing what I am doing. And this is important. It's important to me. Even though I feel like sometimes I get nowhere, even though I sometimes am disappointed in the numbers of hits that I get, but I do get fringe benefits. I mean, I get to talk to people like Mark Crispin Miller, who I talked in my last show, guys like Mark Satin and David Bornstein and Juan Cole, who I talked with on Friday. Was it Friday? Yes, it was Friday. Only for half an hour. I want to get him back on because I want to talk more about this. Because, you know, as much as I want things for American workers, I also want things for the people of Iraq and the people of Syria and the people of Jordan. You know, if they want to have a Muslim country, that's fine with me. You know, I don't particularly want to live there. But I feel that most of the people in these countries are not much different than we are. They want to raise their families, they want to support their families, and they want to better themselves. And I am all for them doing that. And I think American workers in the 40s and 50s, as much good as they did for themselves, didn't really want to do quite so much for workers in other parts of the world. And they certainly want to do a lot less for them now. We talk about outsourcing, and my answer to all that is, let's go ahead and make the world a place where everybody gets paid roughly the same. Where companies, if they're going to outsource, are going to do it for different reasons and for better reasons. I don't necessarily have a problem with outsourcing in the sense of, okay, I work for Siemens, which is a German company, and it's more profitable for them if they're selling stuff in America to build factories in America and build it here rather than build it there and ship it overseas. I mean, that makes more sense, and it helps keep Americans employed, and it helps keep, you know, their company profitable so that they can hire more people in Germany, perhaps. And that's very good, and I like that. But they shouldn't be outsourcing because, well, the labor's cheaper over there. The labor's cheaper in Vietnam or the labor's cheaper in Mexico. They shouldn't be doing it because of that. I mean, they will. I mean, I'm not going to sit there and say they should do it for highfalutin reasons and be honorable and pay Americans more money. No, that's bullshit. They're not going to do it. And you're living in a fantasy world if you think they are. The only way to really prevent that is to have a global labor standard. So that when companies do decide to make a move to a certain area or to put a production plant here or a production plant there, it's not based on who's giving the best bribes. It's based upon what's in the best interest of their short-term and long-term needs. That's why companies should do stuff like that. And if you've got to put a gun to their heads, figuratively speaking, through laws and regulation to make sure they're not screwing their working people, and that's what you got to do. Because they're not going to willingly do anything that they don't have to do. And some companies are better at it than others. Some companies are better than others as far as their how they treat their working people. And I respect companies that treat their work. Excuse me. Oh, that was wonderful. I respect the companies that treat their working people well. And I disrespect those that don't. I don't know. I couldn't think of an ending to that. But I do respect companies that treat their employees well. And I'm a big believer in capitalism. You know, let's not make the assumption that I am against capitalism. I love capitalism. I love the idea of being able to make more money and being able to better yourself financially. I'm not very good at it, but I love the idea of it. But capitalism in and of itself is not the type of system that you want to live under, because by itself, capitalism can be pretty fucking vicious. Just like, you know, any type of thing where one side dominates like that can be pretty vicious. I mean, I think communism has got a pretty good track record of being a failure. You know, people live under pretty bad circumstances under communist governments. They don't always have the amount of stuff that we get. That's why I'm a liberal and why I'm not a communist. Although, to hear a right-winger talk, there's no difference between a liberal and a communist. And, of course, people who don't know anything are making that argument. They don't understand what liberalism is. They don't understand what communism is. It's as simple as that. And, you know, you really can't always educate people in a very simple way about that sort of thing. Because, you know, people are involved in their own lives. And they have other things to think about and to talk about and to do. There's work to be done. There's families to be raised. And some people have been given a mantle of trust. The press and the leaders, our political and business leaders, have been given a mantle of trust because it comes naturally in the society that we've built. These are people who are movers and shakers, as it were. And we give them the trust that they know what the hell they're doing. And a lot of times, they don't live up to that trust. The professional media certainly has not lived up to that trust by not doing the job that they're supposed to do, not being active, objective reporters of the truth, but rather they are currently being more like cheerleaders for one side or the other, and more often the right wing and the corporate interests. Anyway, let's take a little break. We're going to hear from our friends at BuzzFlash.com, and we're going to play a little music. And, you know, and then we'll be back with the interview with Juan Cole from JuanCole.com. And that's pretty good. I enjoyed that. We did that Friday. Sam, play us out.
We'll be right back with more of the Papa Joe Radio Show.
Hi, welcome back to the BuzzFlash.com GOP Hypocrite of the Week. He's back for a second week, the puppet-in-chief, George W. Bush. One of our BuzzFlash readers wrote that Bush is the kind of pilot who, if he's steering a plane across the country and finds that he's out of fuel around Albuquerque, will insist on flying to Los Angeles anyway without stopping for more gas. "That's my plan, and I'm sticking to it," he tells his co-pilot. His co-pilot warns him that he's crazy and that the plane and passengers will crash in the next 100 miles as the fuel runs out. Bush, a self-described decisive man, dismisses the reality of the situation. "Now, I'm a swaggering man, and we said that this was a non-stop flight to Los Angeles, and I'm a man of my word. Besides, God chose me to pilot this plane, and we're in the Lord's hands." That's our George, all right. Sure of himself and God's anointment of him as the Lord's pilot. Even if the reality here on Earth is going to lead to an imminent crash and kill everyone on board. Some harsh critics wouldn't call George's motivations religious. They would insist he's boneheaded, maybe with a calcified brain from doing too much drugs or too much alcohol. There's also ample evidence to indicate that his brain has been running on one cylinder since birth. But he gets by because of the Bush dynasty claim of royal entitlement. Take this week, for instance. Bush declared that everything is just fine in Iraq as GI deaths surpass 1,000. The UPI reports U.S. military injuries have exceeded 17,000. Thousands of Iraqis have died, and it appears this month we may set records for civilian and Iraqi casualties. Insurgent attacks, bombings, and kidnappings are on the upswing. Large parts of Iraq are under rebel control, but things are looking good in Iraq to good old two-faced liar George. Bush even brought in CIA asset Ayad Alawi to bolster the Bush-Cheney lies about the Iraq catastrophe and try to make Kerry look like a naysayer. Of course, Alawi is as much Bush's puppet as Bush is Cheney's puppet, but the show must go on as the Iraqi nation deteriorates further into a bloodbath and as our soldiers die for a president who cohabits the fantasy world of Neverland with Michael Jackson. No one even knows who the enemy is anymore, but we can speculate that Hypocrite George has created more terrorists than he's succeeded in killing. That's a dubious achievement that only a Bush could be proud of. It takes a special kind of talent to be such a colossal failure at protecting America's security. But Bush didn't get to be a master hypocrite without skills. That's why we honor him as the number one inept threat to securing America against terrorism and, once again, the BuzzFlash GOP Hypocrite of the Week. Until next week, just remember our motto at BuzzFlash.com. So many Republican hypocrites, so little time. I'll catch up with you soon.
And we are back on the Cup of Joe radio show. I'm your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Again, let me remind you, the URL is copojoe.blogspot.com, and the email address is joevec@bellsouth.net. And I have a very special guest with me on the phone today, Professor Juan Cole of the University of Michigan. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And JuanCole.com is one of the best sites it's probably the best site as far as getting news from Iraq is concerned, because Mr. Cole is a professor of history, and you've lived in that area before for a while, haven't you?
I lived in the Muslim world for 10 years.
Okay, so you have a very good insight as to, you know, the regular lives of people out there and how they see us.
That's right.
So let me ask you, because I know that the whole war situation, and you've been talking about that daily on your blog, and that's wonderful. But I wanted to find out something because, you know, as Americans, we kind of grow up in a sheltered world. You know, we live in a little bubble that's created by the society that we've built around us. And there's always that kind of grow up, go to school, get a good job, have some more kids, and repeat the process. And you know, I can't see how that happens in a situation like what's going on in Iraq. How do people survive under circumstances like that?
Well, survival is not easy, and of course a lot of people don't survive. There's been massive loss of life in Iraq in the past century. But one thing that has helped people in the recent past is the United Nations Food for Oil Program, which was an exception to the general sanctions that were placed on Iraq by the United Nations. And that program is still in place, so people are getting food. Mr. Bremer, the civil administrator of Iraq for a year, was an American, at one point wanted very much to abolish that program, but was told by his Iraqi advisors that it would cause him enormous hardship and possibly rebellion, and so was argued out of it. He's a free marketeer of an extreme sort, and it was a tough pill for him to have to swallow. So the distribution of food is still going on, and that's seems to me one of the things that has prevented widespread starvation in the aftermath of the war.
Do people trust the UN more than they trust Americans in general there?
No, they don't like the UN either. Decade of sanctions was imposed by the United Nations Security Council, spearheaded, of course, by the United States, but it had an extremely harsh effect on the general Iraqi populace. It included, you know, at one point they prevented chlorine from going to the country because it can be used for weapon making, and chlorine is essential to water purification. So, you know, you had kids, little babies and toddlers dying of diarrhea because they were drinking water that hadn't been purified because they couldn't get chlorine because of the sanctions. So a lot of people in Iraq harbor a certain amount of bitterness towards the United Nations over that, despite the fact that the UN, you know, did have this food program.
So even if by some miracle Senator Kerry manages to pull this thing off and manages to get the UN on our side, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be treated more warmly by the Iraqi people, as some of us on the left hope.
Yeah, I can't see in what way the UN can help the situation in Iraq very much. Conceivably, you could imagine a UN military command that could sign up, say, the Pakistanis and the Malaysians and so forth. But in general, I think given the degree of violence and chaos in Iraq, most countries' leaders would much prefer not to get involved. I mean, this is their careers on the line if it goes bad. So I just don't think the UN is coming in. But if it did, yeah, there would be some hostility to it. And I saw one interview with an Iraqi woman protester who was saying, people keep talking about expanding the multinational force and bringing more countries in. She said, we don't want that. It means we'll be occupied by more countries.
Right. And obviously they want control of their own areas. Now, from what little I know about Iraqi history, Iraq was created by the British after the fall of the Ottoman Empire after World War I. And really should have been, from what I understand, it should have been three separate provinces because of the Kurds and the Sunnis and the Shiites.
Well, you know, historians are reluctant to talk about shoulds because we think all nation-states are artificial. There's no natural nation-state. They're all constructed by processes of economics and history and politics. So that you end up with a Germany has to do with Bismarck's victory over France in 1870 and 71, and then a lot of politicking with Bavaria and so forth. It's not natural, or it's not a given that Bavaria has to be in Germany or that Austria isn't and so forth. So with regard to Iraq, what was there before the British conquest in World War I was three major provinces of the Ottoman Empire. And those were not nation-states, and people were not, at that time, for the most part, very literate. There were a lot of peasants and tribespeople, and the idea of a nation-state probably was largely absent. So it is an artificial entity, but it's not clear to me that it's more artificial than most other nation-states.
But there does seem to be, among the Iraqi people, a sense of national pride now, where they're talking about, instead of Shiite unification, they're talking about, you know, like Reverend Sistani says about do it for Iraq as a whole, and they do seem to be identifying with themselves a little bit more along those lines.
Oh yeah, well, in the course of the last 80 years, a sense of Iraqi nationalism has grown up, and that's typical throughout the world. A lot of nations were formed after World War I or in the process of decolonization. Which initially maybe didn't have a strong purchase on the imaginations of the ordinary people, and which over time, through schooling and the press and other mechanisms, actually did manage to create a sense of national pride, national unity. I remember reading about Lebanon, which was created by the French quite artificially in 1920, and there were protests by the Sunni Muslims there in the 1920s that we are Syrians, we're not Lebanese. And then I was there in 76 when the Syrians invaded, and the same area, the Sunni city of Tripoli, had protests and people were carrying banners. We're Lebanese, not Syrians. So between 1924 and 1976, they changed their minds.
Well, that's a couple of generations that go through
yeah.
that. You were talking about the UN sanctions. Wasn't there some sort of scandal with the UN Food for Oil, or is that just being overblown by the right-wing press?
No, I think it's a genuine scandal. It's a horrible thing that, the UN instituted this Food for Oil program to allow the Iraqi state to pump some oil and export it in return for food for the people. But the Iraq was set up by the Ba'ath party under Saddam as a kind of mafia. You know, it was a one-party state, and that party was a way of getting hold of goodies. So, you know, if you were high up in the Ba'ath party, you had the nice big houses, and you had big bank accounts in Switzerland and all that sort of thing. So, of course, you know, Saddam skimmed billions off of this program for himself and his cronies, and he couldn't do that without the complicity of some United Nations officials and some of the companies operating in Iraq. So I think it is a genuine scandal. I'm not sure that what exactly it tells you, that the Ba'ath government was corrupt, that there are bureaucrats at the United Nations or international corporations which can be suborned into corruption. This is a big surprise.
No, not really. With human nature being the way it is, it seems like every nation has had that problem. And certainly, it's been going on in the United States a lot longer than a lot of people want to admit. It's just coming out much more in the open now, I think. Is there any really hope? What would happen for us to be able to turn this thing around in Iraq? I mean, what would happen for, you know, the people there to suddenly say, you know, we want to cooperate, or, you know, just stop fighting and stop shooting? What would happen to turn this whole mess around?
Joe, I just don't think that's going to happen.
Have we lost this thing completely?
I think we've lost it, and there's going to be no good news.
I think it's sad because, you know, even though I thought the whole thing was wrong to begin with, I thought if they went in there and they fixed the infrastructure and they really, really helped people out, that there might have been a chance. But they really had no intention of doing that at all, did they?
Well, I mean, I think they did, but in a certain way. But that's not the real problem, in my view. The real problem is they just didn't understand the way that society worked or what people stood for. You know, Iraq under Saddam was a lot like South Africa in the old apartheid days, with the Sunni Arab minority was on top. And it could only stay on top by marginalizing and disenfranchising and brutalizing the Kurds and the Shiites, who, you know, the Shiites were a majority, and together with the Kurds, the vast majority, the Sunni Arabs probably only less than 20%. So, you know, if I don't know, President Eisenhower had invaded South Africa in the 1950s to establish democracy so that make sure that the black Africans in South Africa had one person, one vote, what do you think the Boers would have done to the U.S. troops?
We would still be fighting there today, I think.
Yeah, well, this is exactly what we did in Iraq.
And if we just pull out altogether, will that help, or will that just make things worse?
No, it'll make things worse. They'll fight with each other.
So what do we do? I mean, we're stuck. I mean, whoever gets into office is going to be having to deal with this horrible situation. Is there anything that we can do at all to even lighten the load or to make it less worse than it is?
Well, I think, yeah, there are things we could do to make it less worse. That might be a good campaign slogan. But for instance, I think a lot of the problems go right to the White House, and it's Bush and Cheney that are making poor decisions that make things worse. For instance, just to give you a couple of examples, late last March there was that incident where the four U.S. and there was actually three U.S. and one South African contractors. I mean, actually, there were security guards, private security guards, some people would say mercenaries, were killed in Fallujah, and then their bodies were desecrated. Well, that was a really horrible incident, but it was four guys, and they were apparently cowboys and shouldn't have been hot-rodding around Fallujah like that anyway. And a lot of the other security people in Iraq thought they were idiots. It appears to be the case, from what Newsweek and others have reported with contacts inside the White House, that it was Bush himself who decided that Fallujah as a city needed to be punished for this. I mean, the evidence is that the guerrillas who did this are kind of hit-and-run guys. They're not even necessarily inside the city all the time. But then Bush ordered the Marines to surround the city and besiege it and bombard it, they killed, you know, over 600 people, many of them women and children. It's a city, you know, people are living there.
And that's pretty much against the law, isn't it? It's against the Geneva Convention.
I think that it is against the Geneva Convention of 1949, which governs how occupied territories are administered by the occupiers. And the Marine commander on the ground there has now come out and admitted that he thought that this was a very bad idea. He said, you know, at the very least, if you're going to do something, you're going to wait so it doesn't look like revenge. And people were saying, you know, what was the ratio here? Four Westerners got killed and then 600 Iraqis. Is that how many Iraqi lives are worth in Americans, 150 or something?
Well, you can say the same that we lost 3,000 at the World Trade Center, but they've lost, what, 20, 25,000?
I think probably 25,000 is not a bad estimate for everybody, civilian, military, and so forth.
And, of course, Iraq had
nothing to do with it.
Yeah,
I mean, nor did the Iraqis pose a threat to the United States of any sort. But then also in April, the Bush administration suddenly announced that it wanted to kill or capture this radical Shiite leader, Muqtada Sadr. And Sutter's guys, you know, had strict instructions from him not to tangle with the Americans, and there wasn't anything going on that required this crackdown. And then the Bushies didn't realize how popular this guy was, and that if they tried to get him, it would cause an uprising all over the Shiite South. So they were unprepared for it. They actually lost complete control of the country for a while. So I just think that, you know, if you know, you're in a hole, you stop digging, and this kind of aggressiveness of Bush, you know, now he wants to attack Fallujah again if he gets reelected in November. I think this is inflaming the situation and making things worse.
Well, I think he might do it even if he loses the election. I mean, you have from November to January,
yeah,
where he still gets to be in power. So he might, you know, his father left President Clinton a big mess in Somalia, which President Clinton subsequently got blamed for, even though he didn't bring any of those troops in there. Somebody at work pointed out something to me that I wasn't aware of, but all the people who have been beheaded, all the ones that have been kidnapped, none of them have been people of color. There's been no black people. It's all been white people. And he said that that's because the Iraqis view the black people in America as kind of kindred spirits, people who have been oppressed. Is there any truth to that, or is he just talking?
No, it's ridiculous. First of all, you know, Americans are cute this way, that they see everything in racial terms. And in the Middle East, actually, race doesn't have the same valence. I mean, it doesn't have the same meaning. People don't really talk much about race. You know, you can have people with African ancestry in southern Iraq or in Saudi Arabia, and they can be, like, rich and part of the elite, and nobody, you know, even hardly notices that what their skin color is.
Unlike the American South, where I live.
Yeah, no, it's a completely different way of looking at things. It's not that people are colorblind, it's just that color doesn't really mean much. If you're a Muslim, you know, you go to the mosque, why would anybody care whether you have African ancestry or Arab or Persian or what it is?
Hmm.
So they don't think that way, and you know, if the word "people of color," if you applied it to Iraq, it would be hilarious. Because
I try to be
color?
Nice.
But the fact is that, for instance, they slaughtered those Nepalis, and if those Nepalis had been in the old South, they wouldn't have been served at lunch counter. So it's just not true.
Okay. Is Iraq America Sicily? I'm somewhat of a student of history, and especially with the ancient Greeks. And I don't know how many times in history we see countries that get power and it's just overreach, but that's probably my favorite example. Do you think this could actually bring down America by turning the entire world against us?
Well, I think it's a very serious situation. How big effect it has on America is unclear. But let me give you some scenarios, you know, how things could go really bad. Let's say that we've produced a permanent failed state in Iraq, that it just is going to go on like this for a long time.
Like a massive civil war ongoing.
Well, no. Even just staying like it is. No better, no worse.
Okay, just a few casualties a day, you know, dozen or so a month or whatever.
Well, I mean, last week 300 people were killed.
That's true, yeah.
So
I'm talking about American
like this,
soldiers.
It's 1,200 a month.
Right.
Plus infrastructure. They continue to sabotage the oil pipelines. Several were hit yesterday. They sabotage the electricity, water. I mean, it is a constant struggle. I mean, you were talking about reconstruction, but just to keep things repaired after they've been blown up.
Right.
So let's just say that, and then there's disorder. You know, a lot of roads are not safe. If you want to drive from Najaf to Baghdad, it's just an hour drive. You take your life in your hands. You could well be killed or carjacked. The country is in a really bad state. So if it just stays like this for a long time, the possibility is of continued instability in the oil markets. You know, it's not normal to have $50 a barrel of gasoline, petroleum. There are a lot of countries that don't have petroleum, like Turkey and Jamaica, that they're in danger of being deindustrialized by this thing. How can they run their factories and still make a profit?
So
long-term instability in the petroleum market is very bad for the world economy. It's bad for the United States. Then what if the radicalism that's growing up in some parts of Iraq spreads? I mean, the people in Fallujah have contacts with people in Jordan. And the people in Jordan, in turn, have contacts with people in the West Bank and Gaza. So the Shiites in the south of Iraq have old standing contacts with the Shiites in Saudi Arabia, who are about 10% of the population, and are congregated in the oil-producing areas. What if you start getting sabotage spilling over from Iraq into Saudi Arabia? You're talking about a situation which is potentially extremely harmful to the world economy over time.
Now, I don't really think the way things are going now that the neocons in the Bush administration are going to get their little dream of a peaceful, democratic Middle East by just, you know, country hopping back and forth, because you know they're already pounding the war drums for Iran, and if Bush gets in, he's going to try that. But they can't even succeed in Iraq. But is there any chance of the opposite? Is there any chance of the Iraqis just literally forcing us out at all?
Yes. The Iraqis might force us out. I'd say there's a 50-50 chance that they'll do it sometime in the next 2 years.
I mean, that's remarkable when you compare the militaries of the two. You would think that wouldn't even be, you know, possible. But you're looking at that, and it's just a remarkable situation that how we could have been so stupid as to have gotten into this mess to begin with.
Yeah. Well, if they force us out, it won't be by military means. They could do something like the Iranian Revolution in 1978-79,
mm-hmm.
and that was a situation in which you had repeated urban demonstrations that the Shah tried to put down, and then they just grew. So all through 78, you know, you went from having 10,000 people demonstrate to having 500,000 people demonstrate.
Right.
And if you have, you know, if they come out frequently and in huge, huge numbers in the major cities, Baghdad, Basra, Kirkuk, and so forth, then the place becomes ungovernable, and you can't take 500,000 people out and shoot them.
Right.
And if you try, you know, it just causes more trouble. So at that point, I think they just have to leave.
And, of course, it was because of the Iranian Revolution that we helped prop up, and didn't we help install Saddam Hussein to begin with? And now we're essentially installing Mr. Alawi. Isn't he just basically the same type of deal, just one strong arm replacing another?
Well, I think there are retired CIA people who maintain that the United States played a role in helping the Ba'ath Party come to power in the 1960s, and specifically in helping Saddam Hussein come to power, because the Ba'ath was seen as an Arab nationalist alternative to the communists, who in the U.S. was afraid the communists might take over Iraq. And during the 1980s, of course, in the Iran-Iraq War, the United States formed a strong alliance with the Ba'ath against the Iranian regime. I was very afraid that the Iranians would take Baghdad and stop that. The alliance broke down after Saddam invaded Kuwait. Alawi is an old-time Ba'athist himself who broke with Saddam in the 70s, and at one point Saddam tried to have him assassinated, and who has been conspicuous for trying to organize other defectors, especially ex-Ba'athist officers from the Iraqi military, to overthrow Saddam all through the 90s in close coordination with the U.S. CIA. Ex-CIA agent Robert Baer has maintained that Alawi conducted terrorist operations in Iraq against Saddam, blowing up things, and at one point blew up a school bus, killing a lot of children. So Alawi does have a reputation as a strong man, as a tough guy, but it's not entirely clear that he has you know, any popularity at all. And I think what popularity he had, he squandered by seeming to endorse U.S. military action against his own people.
Right. Well, of course, that's not going to make anybody popular. What always bothers me about people that I hear from this country complaining about what the Iraqis are doing, and I keep saying that, you know, if it was a situation where reverse, you'd be doing the same thing as they were. They are. You know, and I don't know. I just feel really bad that that I'm part of a country that can do this. I mean, I know we've been doing this kind of thing covertly for many, many years, but this is so blatant. It's so out in the open. And it really does scare me for long-term consequences. I know you have an appointment to go to at 12:30.
Right.
So I need to let you go. As much as I would love to continue to talk to you about this, because there's so little I know. I mean, what I know I've learned from reading your site. So.
Well, thank you so much, Joe.
Sure. Professor Cole, thank you very much for being on the show.
I appreciate the invitation.
Thank you much.
Take care.
It's in the interest of...
It's in the interest of...
A long-term peace in the world.
Long-term peace in the world that we
work for a free and secure
and peaceful
Iraq.
And peaceful Iraq. It's in
the interest of.
It's in the interest of
long-term peace in the world.
Long-term peace in the world
that we.
Work for a free and secure.
Work for a free and secure.
And peaceful Iraq. A peace, free, and secure Iraq.
In the midst of the Middle East,
we'll have enormous historical impact.
In the midst of the Middle East,
in the midst of the Middle East,
we'll
have enormous
historical impact.
That was the George W. Singers with Peons Freeans. I love that. That they actually have, I managed to pick up an entire album of stuff. I didn't even heard of them. And I got that because I have my newsgroup reader thing up and running again. And what I really loved about having the newsgroups is the fact that you're able to get so much stuff. And I like collecting soundtracks and audio files. And you can get so much more. It's even better than Kazaa. But the big difference is that you can't really do a search like you can on Kazaa. You have to take what they give you, but you get so much. And that was an entire album of Gunch. And I'll toss in one every now and then. They're all in the same vein, really. They'll take a Bush speech and they'll sing what he was saying. This one was just the best of them. So, anyway, I want to thank Professor Juan Cole for joining me. That's two very good interviews I had 2 weeks in a row. I wish I had somebody lined up for next time. Maybe I will have. I've been emailing Atrios, and I'm going to email Marcos from Daily Kos and Digby from Digsby's blog and see if I can get them on the show. I like doing interviews. I like talking to people, you know. But anyway, that's going to do it for the show tonight. Again, this is Joe Vecchio with the Cup of Joe Radio Show. The blog, again, once more, is cupojoe.blogspot.com, and that email address is joevec@bellsouth.net. And I hope you all have a good few days, and we will see you next show. Bye. Joe Vecchio, the host of the Cup of Joe Radio Show, is proud to be a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 2127. However, the views of Joe Vecchio do not necessarily represent the views of Local 2127, the IBEW, or its affiliate, the AFL-CIO. Please remember to support your working brothers and sisters and help keep the American dream alive. Cup of Joe Radio Show has been a production of Jove Enterprises Incorporated.